This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you ever wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, give us a call right now. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll be exploring another special topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Well, we think of females as being the primary caretakers of the young, from coyotes to kangaroos to kingfishers. But in the world of fish, male parental care is actually more common than female care. And we're going to talk a little bit why that might be later on in the show.
Well, good for the dads. We'll find out some more about that later on. And we'll also welcome a guest to share his story about Merle, the free-thinking dog who changed the author's understanding of what dog-human relationships should be. And that's a little bit later on in the show. Right now, let's take some calls. Here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Diane in Fort Myers, Florida.
Diane, so nice to hear from you. What can we do for you?
Well, my question regards the possibility of teaching adult dogs what toys are if they have no concept of it. Some years ago, I got a cockapoo that was about a year old, maybe a little bit more, and I was so disappointed to find out that he had no idea what toys were. I could not interactively play. No ball, no fetch, no chew toy, nothing. And I kept trying to teach him. I'd say, come on, let's roll the ball, fetch the ball, and now you get a treat, now you get a treat. But one big problem was he didn't care about treats.
Ooh.
He had no interest in treats.
Ooh, that makes it tricky.
All he really ever cared about was what he could sniff on the ground. His nose is to the ground all the time.
Okay.
That's kind of his only interest. And somebody did tell me, well, it's impossible to teach adult dogs toys. I don't know. Anyway, some years later, I acquired a fully mature Lhasa Apso, and I still have both of them.
Okay.
And I thought, well, maybe she'll know what toys are, and then he'll learn from her. But she didn't know what toys are.
Oh.
Not a clue. And I feel bad, number one, because I don't have any interactive play with them.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, because I feel they're bored.
Yeah,
I'd like to try to give them something more to enjoy and occupy themselves
with. Yeah, and good for
with.
You. Good for you for thinking about their mental exercise as well as their physical exercise. There are a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, just briefly, there does seem to be a kind of a critical period for playing with objects, and I've seen quite a few dogs who were, just as you describe, they're older, they don't get to play with objects during these developmental periods, and they just come with, they look at them like, well, what would I do with that?
Yeah.
So here's the good news, though. Most of these dogs you can turn around. It does take a lot of patience, but most of these dogs you can turn around. So one thing I would do is I would figure out what food these dogs really, really, really love. And I don't want to set up competition between the two of them. So you might want to, have one sort of sleeping in the back room and work with one at a time. But if Fido loves chicken, I love chicken, then get one of those little hollow
people
toys.
People food.
Yeah, people food. There you go.
Yeah.
Get one of those little hollow toys and just put a little bit of food inside of it. Accessible, but such that the dog has to nudge or manipulate or put his paw on top of the toy just to get the food out. Let him lick it out. But I did want to pick up on something else that you mentioned. You told us already that your first little dog loves scent, right? Loves smelling things?
Mm. Yeah. His nose is to the ground all the time when we go for walks.
Yeah, so he's telling you what he loves. And so here's a great opportunity for you to let him exercise his mind, but do what he loves. Teach him scent-related discrimination. There are all kinds of, there's a book I think is called Nose Work with Dogs.
Hmm.
Roy Hunter, I think, is the author. Fun Nose Work with Dogs. It's something like that. And it's basically about, you can teach your dog, was this water from the hot water tap or was this water from the cold water tap? I mean, their noses can actually distinguish that.
Hmm.
If you learn a little bit about scent discrimination training, you could have a ball with this dog. It might be, you could end up with one of the world's finest little sniffer dogs.
you never know. Diane, good luck. Thanks very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we received an email from Carrie in Madison, Wisconsin, who heard our program about the emotional lives of animals. Remember that?
Yeah.
Of course. She says it made her wonder about dog intelligence. And here's what she writes. A popular research technique in humans right now is the functional MRI, which allows us to see how and where the brain lights up when exposed to various stimuli. Has anyone done research on dogs using functional MRIs? And if so, do the findings tell us anything about intelligence in dogs?
It's That's a wonderful question. It's a great question. I know of MRIs that are done on primates. But the trick with an MRI is that to do an MRI on a dog, as people, anybody who's had an MRI knows, you have to remain motionless.
Yes.
And you have to remain motionless surrounded by an unbelievable ocean of horrible, hateful noises.
They're really loud.
And they really stress that you cannot move for obvious reasons. You're taking a photograph of different sections of your brain. So you can't do the same kind of, you know, asking people to make sort of intellectual decisions and make cognitive choices while they're awake while you're doing an MRI. Actually, it's, you know, there's a functional MRI. There's also PET scans, PET scans, that are another way to look at actually how blood is being used in different areas of the brain that actually has given us a tremendous amount of information about how the brain is used. But I have, it's a great question. I haven't yet seen anything on a conscious dog. But I will keep my brain alert and my ears pricked. That would be a great topic to talk about.
I actually would. That's a, it's a wonderful question. And how do people send in questions?
Well, you know, we'd love to hear from you. One of the ways you can talk to us is to send us an email question. Go to our website at callingallpets.org.
And you'll find how to, well, you can mail us right from there, from
Absolutely.
The website. Okay. And if you want to talk to us, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Kim, and I'm from Manassas, Virginia.
Kim, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I had three cats, Max, Pierre, and Meep, and Pierre was slowly dying of kidney failure, and Pierre did die, and as he was dying, Max started getting aggressive and pushed him away from food and beat him up.
Aww.
And then Meep got sick with a kidney infection,
Aww.
And didn't Max do the same thing? So we ended up slamming Max in solitary confinement. And we put him in a Tokyo cage for a while, and we had the streetcar named Desire. He was Stanley, and she was Blanche. And, but he only acts out when people are sick, and I'm not kidding. Even if I get sick, he'll go after my Achilles tendon.
I believe you, and I'll tell you, this is not something that I commonly hear. This, what I have heard related to this is both dogs and cats whose behavior has changed when a woman gets pregnant. And that's not common, but it's not unheard
not
of.
Not out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I probably heard of 20 cases in 20 years or so. You know, that's not a lot. But nonetheless, they're very clear. I mean, there's really no question about it that, in my mind anyway, that it's, I can't find any other trigger.
So is it a scent? Does people are, or animals are letting off?
Interesting. Here's what I think you should do. I think you should figure out a way to use this cat. You know, this is like a CAT scan. You're going to, like, use this cat to figure out who's sick and who's healthy. You could make a lot of money with this cat.
Yeah.
He's gender sensitive. He when he gets that way, he has more issues with men.
Okay.
So he's a hormone detector.
Okay.
As well as an illness detector.
Another skill.
We give him solitary confinement, and then we do the vitamin drops in wet food for him, and just keep him separated from the sick cat until everybody gets well again, and give him equal time of petting, and then his scent goes on her, and her scent goes on him.
Well, I would, obviously you're doing a lot of wonderful things. Another possibility is to talk to a veterinary behaviorist about some kind of some other kind of medication. Obviously, you use some of that. But again, I think probably your best bet is to figure out how to make a lot of money out of this cat and end up, you know, saving lives. You know, all the jokes about lab tests and CAT scans. Well, you've got your CAT scan right there. Yeah, very interesting. I wish I had some magic sort of brilliant idea for you to instantly turn things around, but I don't think there's going to be an instant cure. But I would basically use a lot of operant conditioning, a lot of reinforcement for good, consequences for bad, and see if you have any luck with that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll examine parental care in fish and find out why a father's involvement is so important. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time now to take a look at this week's topic. And Tricia, it turns out male fish make great dads.
Larry says that with such pride.
Proud of those fish.
Representing the male section of the species. Well, you know, male fish do make great dads, and it's true of many male fish. Smallmouth bass, for example, bluegills, you know, animal fish that we know really well, they're great daddies. They're the ones who prepare the nest for the eggs. They guard the eggs. They guard them from predators. They guard them. They also guard them from other males of the same species who would like to fertilize them themselves. They keep the eggs clean as they're developing them. Some of these males even brood the young in their own mouths, Larry.
We have a pier at our lake home, and the bluegills actually spawn and have their beds right next to our pier, so we can watch them. And frankly, it's really easy to catch them when they're on those beds because they attack anything that comes their way, those male fish.
Because they're so protective.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of bluegills, did you know, Larry, they have this great reproductive strategy. A couple of other species of many marine animals actually do this, and ocean go or lake going animals. Some of the males take on the coloration of the females.
Uh-huh.
And so there's sort of these little fish in drag that basically that allows them to sneak in and fertilize the eggs of another male because the other male thinks it's just another female laying eggs. Pretty sneaky,
cool,
hey?
Guys. Well, why is male care so common in fish and not, for example, in birds or other mammals?
Well, you know, it's a really good question. The answer probably lies in the way these different species reproduce. We know, for example, you know, we know that birds, mammals, females produce eggs that are fertilized internally, and they develop internally, most importantly.
Yeah.
So the females produce a lot of energy to grow these, you know, these young up to some point in which they're able to be off on their own. So females have a huge amount to gain or to lose if their offspring don't survive. But fish are different. Fish eggs are fertilized externally, and they develop externally. Males and females release their eggs and sperm into the water. They just, you know, out there in the water. So the female doesn't have any more investment than the male does. At that point, you know, they both just produce these sex cells,
yeah.
And the female doesn't have any more investment than the male. And it turns out that the larger a female is, the more eggs she produces. So it's to her advantage to go off, leave the eggs that she's produced,
yeah.
Go off and eat. I love this. I want to be a fish. Her job is to eat as much as she can. So the next time she spawns, she can create even more eggs.
Some guys may be wondering this. Does the size matter for male fish?
Not matter, Larry. Size does not matter in males. It matters in females. But what makes male fish attractive to other females, at least in these cases, is actually their nest guarding behavior. The better nests they have and the more protective they are, the more the females are attracted. Because after the female lays her eggs, off she is to go eat and eat and eat while the males fertilize and protect the eggs while they develop.
Well, you know what? As a dad, it's nice to hear some good news about fathers.
Well, and you're a good daddy, too.
Okay. And I'm good at giving our number, too. It's 1-800-462-7413 if you'd like to join in. And we have some callers online. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Oh, hello. This is Helen from Green Bay, and you two are just delightful. Just delightful. And I'm pleased to be able to call today with my question about our 11-year-old Cocker Spaniel. And Rusty is very, very well behaved. We've had her for 8 years. We got her from the Humane Society. And when we would say her name, she would turn and she stays right with us. We live in the woods, so there are no streets near for her to get run over. And what's happened is she's lost her hearing.
Aww.
So my question is, what do we do to ensure her quality of life? Because she's very active. She's just a doll. But I don't know exactly what to do other than to get in front of her and get her sight before we touch her because she jumps, you know. So, like, do you have experience with this?
Yeah, there are a couple things you can do. The bad news is that there's nothing anybody can do about her running free in the woods. It's just, you know, there's just nothing you're going to be able to do to make that safe for her anymore. So regrettably, that part of her life is probably over. And I have an older dog who's just losing her hearing, and it's just breaking my heart. So I'm very sympathetic to this. But the fact of the matter is she's no longer safe like she used to be. So I would take her out on long lines now when you're going to go on long walks. She can still get to have the walk. And will it be as much fun? No. You know, but they say growing old is not for sissies. So it's just, we just have to swallow and accept that one. But when she's closer in, there are some things you can do. One, you can, for example, say she's in the backyard just going potty late at night. You can teach her to come to flashing the lights at night.
Oh, okay.
So you can teach that. You can teach a variety of hand signals as long as you can get her looking at you. And that's, again, that's the trick. You can use lights at night. That works really well. You can also use vibration. If she's not too far away, you can teach her if you stomp on the ground or throw something behind her, they'll often learn to sense the vibration from something hitting the ground if they're not too far away. So basically, you want to look at what kind of visual signal can you teach her to? And you just teach her like she was a puppy, you know, learning just like you teach her to come. Mm-hmm. Why, when you say Rusty come, you're going to teach her to come when you flash the lights. You flash the lights, be really close to her, lure her around with a piece of food and give her food, make a big deal. Oh, you're so smart, good girl. And she'll learn fast enough if you find something she really loves. So just think about, how can I use touch and how can I use the visual sense to try and help her get around in the world. So I think you can be quite successful with those as long as you accept that you do have to put boundaries on there that weren't there before.
Yeah. Those are excellent. I really needed to hear you tell me that her running free in the woods days are over. I needed to hear that because I don't think I would have done that, and my husband needs to also now listen to your advice as well.
It's a tough one. I really hear you. It's a tough one. But, you know, I can't do things I used to be able to do either.
We're just glad she's well-behaved because she's just a doll. So I think we can take your information and move forward, and thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Helen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You're a peach. Thank you. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Carol calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hi, Carol. How can we help?
Within the last year and a half, I've been fortunate enough to get a little hobby farm about an hour away. And between my boyfriend slash partner and I, we're up there maybe about four times a week, occasionally overnight. And have some chickens.
Ooh, fun.
I would love to have a cat, but an outside cat. We were hoping that maybe a stray would come along and we could kind of attract it, but it hasn't happened. So I'm wondering, I don't want to incur the wrath of Patricia and cat owners that are speaking jowl with their pets, you know, 24/7. Is it possible to have a cat who would stay around? I know that, you know, you've talked a lot about the solitary nature of these cats, and I guess I want to get some suggestions.
Let me can answer your question very specifically. There's actually an organization. There are several organizations all around the country, obviously. The one in Wisconsin is called Friends of Ferals. And what they do is take in feral stray cats that have been brought in who are living in the wild, who are causing problems. Perhaps a farmer has, you know, 12, 15 cats. And often it's a big problem with farmers. They don't want that many cats, and they really need help.
Hmm.
I have a friend who's a farmer, and she says she spent thousands of dollars spaying and neutering cats, and they just keep showing up and keep coming. She's just basically given up.
Yeah.
And so you know, those kind of people really need our support. So there's some organizations that do take in animals who have been living outside, who are accustomed to living outside, spay, neuter them, vaccinate them, and then find appropriate homes for them. Now, of course, what's controversial is what's appropriate or not. There are many, this is very controversial, there are many people who feel very, very strongly that no cat should be re-released into the wild because of their predation on wild animals, particularly birds. And there's no question that cats can have a profound effect on wildlife, ground nesting birds, for example. So that's something you do want to think about very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is a problem.
Yeah, because we've attracted a lot of birds up there, which is one of the things that's been enjoyable. I didn't know
well,
if that would be
let me ask you this. Why is it that you want a cat out there?
I'm living in such a way right now that I've been a dog person, but my schedule is such it would not be fair to have a dog.
Okay.
And I'm just kind of missing an animal.
Yeah.
And so I know a lot of people have farmsteads, and, you know, there's just cats that are around. And so,
right. Well, you know, maybe if there's a cat that shows up that really needs a home, particularly, you know, cats vary tremendously as individuals. And some cats are not particularly good predators. You know, a lot of cats are. Most cats are. Cats are designed as rodent specialists. 80% of their diet are small mammals. But nonetheless, there's some cats that are really good at hunting birds. I have one. I'm happy to say she is now an indoor-outdoor cat. It's a long story, a lot of angst about letting her out. She doesn't kill birds. But she was declawed before I got her. And I'm really happy to say she doesn't kill birds. She's learned to kill mice. Now, that's also a problem in some ways because that's food for red-tailed hawks, snakes, you know, a lot of native animals as well. So one thing you might want to think about, sounds like you're really missing an animal.
Mm-hmm.
I love that you're being thoughtful about not getting a dog. You know, maybe there's another kind of animal you could get. Some of the little small mammals are very portable, extremely interactive. Oftentimes people sort of close their eyes and wince when I talk about rats. But I got to tell you, domestic rats that you buy in pet stores, they are phenomenal pets. They're intelligent. They're social. You can teach them tricks. They sit on your shoulders. They're cuddly. They kiss your face. So, you know, you really might want to think about some other kind of animal.
Hmm.
Just a possibility.
Carol, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. If you'd like to join in, here's that number to call, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, learn the lessons of a free-thinking dog, just as our guest did after he took on his own free-thinking dog named Merle. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this week we welcome Ted Carasotti to the program. Ted's the author of a new book called Merle's Door, Lessons from a Free-Thinking Dog, and he joins us today to talk about it. Ted Carasotti, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
Tell us how you met Merle.
It was April 1991, and some friends and I had driven from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, down to south of Bluff, Utah, to do a river trip on the San Juan River. And as we were coming into the put-in at about 11:30 at night, out of the river, out of the darkness, this golden big dog came out of the night, panting, his front paws tapping the ground. And we opened our doors. He came right over to me. He sniffed my bare thigh, looked up into my eyes with a luminous, excited glance and said, "You need a dog." And I'm it.
And did you say, "Yes, I do"?
Not at that very second. I thought he was a pretty handsome dog, although he was pretty rough around the edges. He looked like he'd been living out in the desert by himself, his fur matted with twigs and grass, and he was quite lean. And I had been looking for a dog for over a year. I had looked at litters of Samoyeds, thinking that that kind of dog would be just right for a winter person like myself, and looked at Labradors, but no pup had given me that undeniable heart tug that said, "We are a team." And I was still set on getting a pedigree dog, but Merle, who wasn't called Merle then, came right over to my sleeping bag when I put it down, dug a little nest by my side, turned, and looked me right in the eyes and said, "I am yours." And he just worked his way almost immediately into my heart. I thought he was a very handsome dog, and he just had this collected, self-possessed air. He didn't jump. He didn't lick. He just had a very quiet, steady aura about him. And he had, by all appearances, had been surviving in the desert on his own, and he just knew a lot. He knew how to avoid rattlesnakes and swim rivers and climb rocks, and he was competent, and I really like that.
You know, you describe him as a free-thinking dog. When did you decide that Merle was a free thinker?
Oh, gosh. Almost immediately, he expressed that he wanted to do things his own way, and that he could learn quickly. We got back to Wyoming. There were some coyotes howling outside the cabin. He really wanted to go outside and get them. And I said, "You can't. There's too many of them. They'll kill you." And I got him quieted down. And the next morning, I just let him out of the cabin, and he went exploring. And about 10 minutes later, as I was brushing my teeth, he came up to me in the bathroom and looked at me with an expression that said, "You are wasting your time. You don't know what's happening out there. Hurry up." And he proceeded to show me so much of the outdoor world that I hadn't noticed, because I'm a bipedal human. My nose, 5.5 feet off the ground? And he had his nose down in the earth amongst the spoor of elk and grizzly bears and wolves. And immediately I noticed that in the distance, his body language would change as he smelled different animals. He was perpetually excited about finding coyotes. Wolves, however, he'd give me a glance that said, "The big dog has stood here."
Well, you write about the dangers of letting Merle run loose near your property. You talked a little bit about that. And, you know, there are farmers who will shoot dogs who come near their livestock, as an example. Knowing that Merle loved to chase these animals and that there was a danger to go along with it, why did you really decide to allow him to freely come and go into your home?
Well, the first big animal that he encountered in Wyoming, the very first morning that we walked from the cabin down to my office, about a mile and a half, was a bison. And there are a lot of bison up in the northern side of Jackson Hole, where I live, in Grand Teton National Park. And Merle charged the bison. The bison hooked him with his horn. Merle ran behind my knees, and I knelt and put my arm around his shoulder and said, "That's a bison. Bison will kill you. This is the way you get around a bison." And we did a big circle, and Merle never chased bison again. And he seemed to realize that wildlife was off limits to be chased, whereas cattle, which helped him, I believe, survive down there in the Navajo Nation — he loved to chase cattle and cut out calves — he started chasing when we got back to Wyoming. As you said, ranchers will shoot dogs that are chasing cattle. So I felt that if he were going to be a free-roaming dog, as are almost all the dogs in Kelly, he needed to learn not to chase cattle. And it was a habit that we got rid of by my allowing him to chase them. I put a choke collar on him and about 50 feet of light rope, and snubbed him when he went after them and shouted no, and he only needed 3 times of that, and he never chased cattle again. He was one of those compliant dogs, thankfully, that learns quickly, likes to please their human, and was willing to live within some of the boundaries that I set down for him.
Ted, I know there are people who are going to criticize you for letting him be at risk. Obviously, a freer life is a life with a little bit more danger. What's your response to people who argue that you should have confined Merle more?
I'm just not a believer in confining dogs, cats, children, because we are of the opinion that we have to protect everyone from all risk at all time. Life would be incredibly boring and so much less rich if we live that way. Granted, when I went to Seattle, I didn't let Merle roam free. He was on a leash, just like all the other dogs in Seattle or Boulder or other big cities that we visited. But it certainly seemed in Kelly, once he demonstrated that he knew all about cars and he could walk on the park road and drift over to the side when he heard a car coming, he didn't chase wildlife, he didn't chase cattle, there seemed to be no reason not to allow him to have his own life. Likewise, the gray cat, who lived 11 years outside all the time, coming and going through the dog door, his cat door, lived a very rich life. And yes, when he was 11, I believe he was probably eaten by coyotes. But if we asked Gray Cat, if he were in the studio with us right now, I believe he would say, I would much prefer having had 11 joyous years being an outdoor cat than having been confined to the house and living 17 years. And I feel much the same for myself. I'd rather live, 100 good years than 150 boring ones. And it's just a different way of living. And I'm not judging anyone who wants to keep their cat or dog inside, but I would ask them to remember that dogs are really genetically and psychologically gray wolves. And they still have the hearts and souls of gray wolves who love to run. And so if people do live in cities, they need to remember that dogs aren't goldfish. They need not only a walk each morning and evening on the leash, but they would really enjoy off-leash time with other dogs during the day or in the evening at a park, so they really can be dogs and read the books of their world through their noses and become better mannered dogs by spending time with their peers, and certainly healthier dogs because they actually get to run at a nice quadrupedal pace instead of our slow two-legged pace.
Ted, based on your experiences with Merle then, what is it do you think our dogs really want?
What do dogs want? As I said in the book, they want someone to respect their selfhood. Primarily, I really believe that dogs cherish being recognized for the unique personalities that each dog is, and having their human allow them some of the idiosyncrasies and quirkiness that all of us have. I also think that they really, as we've said now for the past 5 minutes, value some time on their own to explore it at their pace. And the analogy I often use for folks is you're reading the morning paper over your coffee. You've got a collar and a leash around your neck. There's a great big dog that weighs 2 to 40 times more than you standing above you. And every time you get halfway down the next paragraph, you get jerked away. That's how a lot of dogs are walked. They're reading the books of their world with their noses down on the ground. And every time they want to pause and reflect and ponder and unravel this fascinating new scent, they're very often jerked away because we as humans are on a way different time schedule and need to keep them moving. That must be incredibly frustrating for dogs, and I think leads to some of the dysfunctional behavior we see. It's why I think that dogs need some time each day on their own while their human is off on the sidelines watching to unravel the books of their world at their speed on their schedule.
Tell us what happened to Merle.
Merle, in his 13th year, developed vestibular disease and became disoriented. He appeared to have had a stroke. He recovered from it. And then, almost when he was 14 years old, he had some seizures. He was diagnosed with a glial brain tumor. And we got his seizures under control. We got the swelling in his brain reduced by using some potassium bromide and some steroids. And he and I spent the last six weeks of his life together, just sitting under his aspen tree sometimes, walking, visiting friends, going to parties. And the last 8 days of his life I spent with him, taking care of him, and then he passed away on his own on a rainy day in June, lying right in the middle of the house he had helped to build and love so much.
Wow. How did your relationship with Merle change your outlook on dog-human relationships?
Merle, just because of the special circumstances in which we met and how finished he was when he appeared, seemed to demand a different level of respect from me than I had given other dogs. And as we lived together, he constantly showed me that he was capable of making very good decisions, taking care of himself, being happy when I wasn't around, and leading what I like to call a self-actualized life, and yet being deeply devoted to me and in love with me just the way I was with him, which mirrors very many good human relationships.
Yeah.
Putting all this together made me feel that our dogs really are thinking beings, clever beings, who deserve a lot more respect than we often give them.
Ted, a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Patricia and Larry, for having me. Thank you so much.
Ted Carasotti is the author of Merle's Door, Lessons from a Free-Thinking Dog, and he joined us today from the studios of Radio Foundation in New York City, New York. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Ted's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. Now, if you think you know the answer to this week's question, just give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and a winner will be selected at random to win a copy of Merle's Door by Ted Carasotti. And here's today's question. In his book, Ted describes how Merle would return home through the dog door every day almost precisely at 5:15 p.m. expecting dinner. And if he hadn't been fed by 5:35 p.m., Merle would walk to the corner of Ted's desk, stand there wagging his tail gently with his right eyebrow arched upward as if to say, "Sorry to bother you, but haven't you forgotten something?" According to Ted, Merle's precise timing could be attributed to his internal clock, also known as a biological clock. In which part of the brain is the biological clock located? If you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the correct answer, check out our website. In about a week, we'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And if you'd like to talk with us right now, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Casey from Lexington, Kentucky.
Hi, Casey. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Love your show. I think I may have a question that that may be a little tougher to answer. I raise and rehabilitate injured and orphaned reptiles in the area, and I have come across a particularly nasty iguana. I have dealt with several. This animal just does not want to be messed with at all. I know they don't make real good pets, but for some reason, this one I just cannot tame down. I've had him for about 2 years, and I'm just looking for any way that maybe I can get him to eat out of my hand, but you get anywhere near the cage, he'll jump through the glass at you. So I'm looking for maybe an alternative way to handle him, to calm him down. He's destroyed two T-shirts, and not to mention a whole lot of skin on my arms.
Whoa, and they can get, for people who don't know, iguanas can get very large.
Yes.
And an aggressive iguana is not something to take lightly.
You are correct.
Not at all. You know what I would try if this was my animal? And bless your heart for doing all this rehab, by the way. That's a wonderful thing to do. Have you tried clicker training?
I have not. You know, because snakes are deaf, so I figured that reptiles, although they can hear, you know, I guess I've never even thought of that.
Yeah, and I don't know a lot about hearing, but I do know that lizards can hear, and there's no, particularly a sound like a click. You know those little clickers you can get? You use them in dog training a lot. Those clicks are wonderful sounds. They move through air really well. They're really easy for the brain to process. It's one of the reasons they're so effective, and it's also one of the reasons why dogs hate having their nails trimmed. Because that click, you know, if you ever... Mm. If they ever learn to associate that click with when you nip them a little too close and you nip the quick and they bleed and it hurts, and then they'll always forever be afraid of that noise. So it's a very powerful sound, and I don't see why it wouldn't work with an iguana. Now, again, I'm not an iguana expert, so perhaps I'm wrong. But the reason I bring that up is that a clicker gives you an ability to do very, very fine-tuned shaping, where you're basically reinforcing a particular behavior, and you can raise the criteria in a step-by-step way. So at first, you just reinforce him, basically teach him that every time you click, he gets a little piece of food. So you'd click, drop a piece of food, and click, drop a piece of food. And then once he's learned to associate the click with a piece of food coming, then what you'd start doing is deciding what behavior are you going to reinforce. And I would start by reinforcing him just being still and quiet and letting you approach the cage without him dashing at it, without him charging it. And so if you have the cage such that, and this would be a logistical issue, you can toss a piece of food in when you're still a ways away, that would be the most effective way to do it. But I think you could probably get a long way. Now, it might be because of something about reptiles that the clicker isn't the best way to go, but that's what I would check into first.
But give that a shot.
Yeah, I would give this kind of shaping, this kind of operant conditioning a shot. The other thing to think of is if he's always that aggressive, I always wonder about a medical condition. So you might
He's never aggressive. He's never tried to actually manually hurt me.
Okay.
He just doesn't want to be messed with. And you know, they've got, you know, a tail that's, you know, it's like being hit with a bamboo reed, an itch in the face with it.
Yeah.
And the claws will tear big chunks out of your skin. But he's doing it just to get away. He's never aggressive. He's never bit me.
Okay.
But if I handle him for longer than 3 or 4 minutes, he's just hell-bent to get out of my arm.
Well, there's always the possibility there's a medical issue, that somehow it hurts him. So that's something that, you know, that's always something to pursue. Is there some kind of damage in his spine, or is there some reason where it's painful to be handled? So that's something else to think about. But if he'll let you do it for a couple of seconds, then I would start reinforcing a couple of seconds and then gradually working your way up.
And putting back, and work longer, and putting back.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck, Casey.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Tricia, let's take a look at an email question. We've got one from Babs in Alexandria, Louisiana, and here's what she has to say. We have a terrible problem with our cat, Mistopheles. He sleeps all day and spends his nights on roach patrol. We live in Louisiana, so roaches are a way of life here in the summer, especially in our 80-year-old home. He fetches them and drops them into our bed, sending us screaming until we find it and get rid of it.
Oh, no.
I've gone sleepless 3 nights in a row. We think he's even encouraged by our screaming. How do we convince him that we are not amused?
Oh, you poor things. This is like the worst possible combination of the natural behavior of a cat. One, they tend to be nocturnal, and two, a very affiliative thing to do. This cat thinks he's being the sweetest thing in the world. He's bringing, look what he's doing. He's bringing you back prey items. What a sweetie. He's bringing you little flowers and wine and, you know, the best possible of gifts. And, you know, it's your problem that you don't like roaches in your bed. Oh, dear. Well, you know, there's always the time honor. This is very complicated. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of learning. But it sounds like you're motivated. So one possibility is to shut the door. Just shut the bedroom door. And I know that's not the answer that you were hoping. Obviously, that's an obvious answer, but you know what? Sometimes simple is just good, and there's nothing very fancy about that. But given you might be like me and love to sleep with your cat, have your cat in bed with you, I adore that. It's half of the reason I want a cat, frankly. But you know what? If it was between that and roaches, I would probably be shutting the door. Other than that, it's probably nice that your cat is preying upon roaches. I'm sure any decrease in that population you're happy to have. I suppose, theoretically, it's quite possible that you could train a cat to deposit the roaches somewhere else. And you would do that again. Clicker training might be a great idea. We talked about that with dog training. You talked about training cats with clickers as well, iguanas, as a matter of fact. So basically, the idea would be to start shaping it. So encourage him to drop it somewhere else, click and give him a treat, and start teaching him to deposit the roaches in a little roach basket, a little roach disposal kit. And so that is possible. You'd want to use operant conditioning and shaping. So that's another possibility. You might want to go online, get some of the resources on clicker training, which can take you step by step on how to do that. And so that's your second alternative.
And how do people email us?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Let's take another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Jim in Severna Park, Maryland.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
My pleasure. I have a Cocker Spaniel, an old Cocker Spaniel. She's about 11 years old now. And ever since she's been a puppy, every time we feed her, she gobbles her food like it's going to be her last meal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've kept her food at a minimum to keep her weight down, and I give her a half a cup of food in the morning and another half cup of food in the evening, and she will woof that down in 3 seconds flat. Doesn't even take the time to masticate.
Now, does she get sick? Does she sort of cough? Does she throw it back up? Does it bother her in some way, do you think?
It does not seem to. It bothers my daughters. They think that she's starving to death. and she will go around to anything where she thinks there's food and open it up. Trash, my daughter's purses, a bag, anything she can get a hold of that she thinks there's food in, she'll rip it up to get to what's in there.
You know what you might want to think about doing? It's not going to stop her eating like she's a cheetah who eats as fast as they can before the lions come in and steal their catch. But you might want to think about switching her to a diet food. That gives her a little bit more bulk, a little bit more fiber, a little bit more satisfying, decreases the calories. So that's just one possibility. Another possibility is to figure out a way to feed her where she just can't bolt it all sort of in one sitting. Although, obviously, it doesn't sound like this is a problem for her. If it bothers you a lot, you might want to go out of your way and do something. But if you can all just get over it, it's probably as long as there's no health-related problem. But, you know, one thing you can do that's sort of fun, as long as there's no health problem associated with this, is to take her dry food, and rather than putting it in a bowl, you can just scatter it on the lawn, or, you know, if you're the kind of housekeeper I am, you can just scatter it all over the kitchen floor. You know? That's what dogs are for, is to clean up kitchen floors, right?
Yes, and she'll do that. She sniffs around the floor, constantly looking for scraps.
And so if you want to sort of expand the time that it takes her to eat her food, and I think actually this is good for dogs because it gives them mental exercise, is have her work for her food a little bit. You know, she could snuffle it out of the grass. You could just toss it in the grass. It'll take her 20 minutes to find the last kibble. But there are also some devices that you can get in pet stores or on catalogs online that are interactive and that the dog has to work a little bit to get the food out. There's some toys where you can put kibble in, and the dog has to sort of roll it around, and one or two pieces come out at a time. The one cautionary note I would add on those is that some of them are really noisy. And if you're a border collie-like human like I am, you're going to be like, who bought that miserable thing? But there are some that are quiet, so you might want to sort of look at those particularly. So that's another idea.
Is it harmful at all to her to gobble her food like that?
No, not if she's not choking, she's not bringing it back up again. Nope. No, dogs are designed pretty much to get it all in their stomach and then lie there and let it get digest. Chewing is not normally necessary.
Good luck, Jim.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. You know, you were talking about noise. I was reminded of some friends who have had a little, a toddler, and Grandpa went out and bought the toddler shoes that have a distinct squeak.
Oh, no.
Every time the child took a step.
And I'll bet there were a lot of steps. To the chagrin of the parents.
The shoes didn't last long. They disappeared after about 2 days. And we have to disappear for this week, as a matter of fact. I really appreciate the show. Thank you, Patricia.
My pleasure, as usual.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0804P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.